From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, working in the urban mines as deep as 80 stories beneath the streets of New York, we hear from Thomas Kelly, whose novel about his years as a sandhog has just been published in paperback. The sandhogs are the men who build the subway, sewer, and water tunnels and the foundations for bridges and skyscrapers. Also, we meet Dutch crime novelist Jan Willem van de Wettering. He grew up in Holland during the German occupation, joined a motorcycle gang, lived in a Buddhist monastery in Japan, then was a cop in Amsterdam. And film critic John Powers reviews two new movies about infidelity, Afterglow and Live Flesh. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The UN weapons inspection team headed by American Scott Ritter has left Baghdad after repeatedly being turned away by Iraqi officials. NPR's Eric Weiner reports from Baghdad.
When they arrived in Iraq earlier this week, the team of UN weapons experts were hoping to conduct a full week's worth of inspections, but they were only able to work for one day. After that, Iraq refused to cooperate with the team, which it says was deliberately stacked with American and British members. So today, the chief inspector, Scott Ritter, announced that his team was leaving Iraq. Ritter, a former U.S. Marine officer, was reportedly investigating allegations that Iraq may have used human guinea pigs to test chemical weapons. On Monday, Ritter's team searched a Baghdad prison where some of the alleged experiments may have taken place. Iraq admits testing chemical weapons on animals, but flatly denies ever carrying out such experiments on human beings. Eric Weiner, NPR News, Baghdad.
Results of a court-ordered mental examination of Theodore Kaczynski will be released today to the judge. The results will be sealed. Kaczynski, who is being tried for crimes committed by the so-called Unabomber, wants to represent himself during his trial. A psychiatrist has examined him over the past week. A hearing on whether Kaczynski may represent himself will be held next week. California Governor Pete Wilson says if Kaczynski is convicted, he should die, whether he's mentally ill or not. Kaczynski's charged with two fatal Sacramento bombings and the wounding of two other men in four of 16 bombings attributed to the Unabomber. After a week of delays, Texas and the tobacco industry have settled a lawsuit out of court for at least $14 billion. Details of the plan are expected to be announced shortly by Texas Attorney General Dan Morales. Bill Zeebel of member station KERA reports from Dallas.
Texas becomes the third state in the country to settle its case with cigarette makers. Missouri and Florida settled their cases in state court last year for a combined total of $14.7 billion. One of 40 states that sued tobacco companies, Texas wanted to recover billions in health care costs it's paid to patients suffering from tobacco-related ailments. Texas sued in federal court under racketeering laws, which could have tripled its original demand of $8.5 billion if it won. Until last week, though, tobacco company representatives said they felt confident enough about winning to go to trial. But an embarrassing case might have endangered the national settlement still being negotiated in Washington. With a tentative deal rumored, the judge twice postponed the trial set to start this week. For NPR News, I'm Bill Zeebel in Dallas.
NASA confirms it. John Glenn is returning to space aboard a space shuttle flight in October. Glenn was the first American to orbit the Earth in 1962. If he goes into space in October, he'll be the oldest man to go into space. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 85 points at 7,776. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is higher for the fourth time in 5 days. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
High technology issues are among the day's most heavily traded. On the positive side, there were stronger than expected earnings from Sun Microsystems. And Bank America Robinson Stephens said it expects Ascend Communications to deliver earnings at the high end of expectations. However, Lehman Brothers did make cautionary remarks on Micron Technology, based on recent declines in prices for computer memory chips. Boeing is lower after the Wall Street Journal reported that Philippine Airlines has canceled an order for four 747 jumbo jets valued at $600 million. And Nordstrom, Inc. has lost nearly 10% after the retailer warned that fourth quarter earnings will fail to meet expectations. I'm Doug Krisner.
The stock market in South Korea lost ground today. Analysts say it was a correction on recent big gains. Investors are reportedly worried there will be more big bankruptcies in the country. Further, Dow Jones News Service says South Korean policymakers are sending uncertain signals on U.S. banks' plans to help repair the South Korean debt crisis. Korean policymakers are drafting their own proposal before a meeting next week with foreign bankers in New York. Internet browser company Netscape says it'll soon lay off 400 workers. The company wants to offset millions of dollars in losses. The company says it wants to cut costs by laying off about 13% of its workforce. Netscape estimates it'll lose $80 million in the latest fiscal quarter. The company blames pressure by rival Microsoft and poor sales in Asia and Europe for the losses. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tom Kelly spent 3 years working underground in the urban mines far below the city streets. He worked with the Sandhogs, the men who built the subway, automobile, sewer, and water tunnels in New York City, and the foundations for the city's bridges and skyscrapers. Kelly worked on a particularly dangerous project, New York City Water Tunnel No. 3. 23 men were killed during the construction of the tunnel. Kelly used the money he made working on the tunnel and other construction jobs to put himself through college. He earned a BA in political economy from Fordham University and a master's in public administration from Harvard. At the age of 35, he wrote his first novel called Payback, based on his experiences underground. It's just come out in paperback. On this archive edition, we have an interview with Kelly recorded last year when the novel was first published. In this reading, the men are taking a train car down to where they work.
They passed 1 mile into the earth, then 2 miles and three. Overhead, life went on, oblivious to their endeavors, 80 stories beneath the streets and living rooms of the city. 4 miles in, the train stopped. Billy and the men stepped off. The man car started back toward the shaft. As it prepared for work, the sound of the train receded and the gang was alone, as remote as anyone would ever be in New York City. The mule barked instructions. Billy and the gang climbed up on the jumbo drilling platform with its three levels, three drills to a level. The drills were run by compressed air, weighed over 100 pounds each. Billy wrestled his drill into position. By the time he was set up, he was slathered in grease. The light was dim, the air worse than usual. Billy felt like he was breathing through wet wool. He stood a hair under 6 feet tall, and his hard hat scraped the raw rock ceiling above his head. He hunched slightly and, with Frankie holding his drill bit to the rock face, let rip. The other sandhogs started drilling, taking up where the swing shift had left off. The howl engulfed them.
Would you give us a sense of what it's like to go down 80 stories beneath the surface of the city?
Well, I guess I can think about the first night I went down, and the shaft I went down the first night was only about 600 feet. But, you know, you've heard about it, and you know you're going under the ground, and you get on this cage with a bunch of other men, and all of a sudden you're going down, and you're going down. And, you know, you're expecting it to stop, and it doesn't for quite some time, and you get out. It's rather awe-inspiring, you know. I mean, the rock down there is 440 million years old, and human beings really aren't supposed to be there. So, I mean, with technology and whatnot, we can go down and build these tunnels now. But it's pretty... And in the book, I describe early on a scene where a guy comes the first night, and he's a big, rough, tough guy, and he goes down on the cage, and he just won't get off. And that would happen on a regular basis. I mean, a lot of people don't know what to expect till they get down there, and a lot of people just, you know, don't really want to be there.
Yeah, you know, I like the way you just described it. This is a place humans weren't meant to be.
Yeah, very audacious of us.
So, did you ever lose your confidence or lose your courage doing the work?
You know... That's a good question. Not really. You know, it's like, you know, you talk to cops, you talk to firefighters. You talk to people who do dangerous stuff, and the minute you start thinking, my God, this is dangerous, you're probably in big trouble. I mean, there were a couple incidents down there where I came very close to grievous injury. And maybe because I was young and stupid, I don't know, it didn't seem to be that big of a deal. You know, my mother was reading the book going, oh, my God, I never realized that was the kind of work you were doing. So it's a good thing she didn't know. I would have been flipping burgers in White Castle instead, I guess.
Well, what's the riskiest part of the work?
You know, working in the heading where you're doing the actual mining, you know, when you're drilling and blasting or and sinking shafts. I mean, but like I said, guys have been killed doing so many different things. You know, because when you're first tunneling, you know, the ground, you're not sure, you're never sure exactly how stable the ground is going to be. I mean, the engineers come in and they make assumptions, but, you know, you hit areas of bad rock and, you know, and there's been some major cave-ins. There was one, when it first started back in 72, there was a huge cave-in on the job where luckily no one was killed, but, you know, they had no idea they were about to hit that rock. So, I mean, just the fact that you're going into the earth, you're not really sure what you're going to be hitting.
And what are you actually doing down there? You're digging deeper and deeper for tunnels or to put supports in for skyscrapers. What else are you doing when you're working down there?
You know, mostly I work just doing straight tunnels. I've never worked on a major foundation for a skyscraper. I've worked on some smaller foundations. You know, and one is, you know, you're going down maybe 60 feet is deep, and the other you're down 800 feet. So it's really, you know, one is really mining. We used to have a saying, we go after the hole, not the coal. You know, it's really old-fashioned hard rock mining where you're really drilling and blasting. And although now that's been supplanted by something called the mole, which is a big underground digging machine that has made it much less labor-intensive.
When a newcomer was starting to work underground and wasn't sure of their footing or was lacking in confidence, would the other men pick up on that, and what would their reaction be?
Oh, they'd torture you.
you know, nice I didn't and tell sensitive,
it. Yeah. I didn't. I mean, you know, I mean, on the exterior, they're very gruff. I mean, I didn't tell anyone I was going to college till I was there for 6 months. That would have been the death knell. Yeah, you go to college, you know. So, I mean, you were sort of better off establishing yourself as a worker before you let anything skip about, you know, reading books at all day. But yeah, they, you know, it's like in most construction. You know, I used to compare it. It's almost like going, not as harsh, but it's kind of like going to jail or prison, maybe, where, you know, they're going to tease you and push you and just see how much they can take. And, you know, maybe they're bored and they just want to have fun with you. You know, I don't know.
So what would have been so terrible if the guys found out that you were going to college?
Well, it's not so terrible. I mean, there were other people down there who were going to school. But, you know, you wanted to, you know, there's this whole notion of, you know, the college boy thing where they think you're just down there interloping or maybe your daddy got you the job or something. So, I wanted to be established just as a worker first, and then they were great. I mean, the guys, in particular the older guys who didn't have the chance, you know, that I had. I mean, guys who, you know, grew up in the Depression and came out of high school and went to World War II or went to Korea and, you know, came from backgrounds where nobody went to college, you know. And so a lot of them sort of vicariously, you know, lived through me in a sense that they really were very supportive. And, you know, if I had a test the next day, they'd say, all right, kid, go over there and hide for an hour, you know, read your book, you know. Which was great, and they were very supportive, and I'll always be appreciative of that.
Well, so you'd be reading 800 feet underground?
yeah, trying to hide from the boss, you know. Don't tell anyone.
Oh, that must have been interesting. So but you were a worker before you were a college student. Weren't you down doing the tunnel work for years before you went to college?
No, not the tunnels I started right before I went to college, but I had been in work in construction from about the time I was 16, so, and I didn't go to college until I was 21, so I had about 5 years of work experience before I went to college.
Why did you decide to go to college when you did?
I decided I didn't want to break rocks for the rest of my life, I guess. No, I always read a lot, and I didn't come from a background where, I mean, nobody I knew went to school. Both my brothers dropped out of high school. My parents dropped out of high school. So there wasn't like a very, you know, academic fast track. And it wasn't until I'd been out working for a few years and decided, And after my father died when I was 20, and all he ever said to us was, get an education, don't be like me, you know. And we kind of laughed at him. I mean, he went to ninth grade. What did he know, you know? And so I guess, you know, partly motivated out of guilt and all sorts of other feelings that maybe I'd let him down, I sort of went and, you know, started going to junior college at night and then realized that I wasn't as stupid as I thought I was and, you know, I started to do okay. And then decided, you know, a lot of things. I remember reading how, you know, Jack London had found in his biography how when he was a young man he found that brain power lasts a lot longer than back power and gets paid a lot more. So I started to think along those selfish terms too. And yeah, it's, you know, the construction, and especially in the tunnels, I mean, it's tough work. I mean, a lot of these guys, you know, it takes a very heavy toll after, you know, a number of years. So, I mean, you start to see that and start to realize that maybe you want to do other things, you know.
You said that you realized when you were in college that you weren't as stupid as you thought you were. What made you think you were stupid?
Well, you know, I mean, you grew up a certain way, and I think you see this, and, you know, I mean, like when I was in high school, you know, we barely went to school, we were always working, and the teachers were very fond of telling us how stupid we were and how we would be digging ditches for the rest of our lives, and the cops reinforced that, and, you know, there was a lot of sort of this negative, like, oh, you'll never amount to anything in life, and after a while, I think it kind of seeps in, and you start to believe it, you know, you develop a negative self-image or a low self-esteem that, you know, some people never get over. You know, I was lucky enough to sort of step back and be able to examine that and see what it meant and move beyond it. But it's tough. I mean, you see these, you know, kids coming up today, and it's, you know, it's sad. It's a lot of people never get past that. I was lucky.
At first, you didn't want the men you worked with to know you were going to college. Did you want your friends in college to know that you also worked underground doing construction and mining?
Yeah, I guess, to a certain extent. Well, I mean, I never plugged in on the whole social scene because I was a little bit older and and whatnot, but sometimes it was kind of fun to sort of rub it in their face a little, I guess.
How?
Well, a lot of them, there were a lot of great students, in various institutions I went, but there were other ones who were just there because, daddy was giving them the money, and they had no conception. And it was during the whole Reagan era, and a lot of them had this very superior attitude that I found, almost borderline, they had an attitude of superiority that I found a bit abrasive, and they were so convinced that, they should be there. Meanwhile, they were only there because someone else was footing the bill and taking care of everything. And they would look down on the, the workers in the cafeteria or whatnot. So I didn't respect that. And I felt like, hey, I'm doing my own thing. And I guess I had a bit of a chip on my shoulder, which, I realized later can be a negative thing. But I was lucky that I channeled it in something positive, I believe.
My guest is Tom Kelly. His novel Payback is based on his experiences working on underground construction jobs in New York City. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Thomas Kelly. His novel Payback is based on his experiences working underground, constructing a water tunnel far beneath the city streets of New York.
Part of your novel Payback is about the construction rackets. And how do they work?
Well, I mean, there's so many different ways, it can be as simple as one guy going on a job, there was a guy I know who told me this story who was a carpenter shop steward on a job in New York back in the 80s. And the company was, subcontractor was trying to get them to really ease off on some of the rules, the work rules that made it, a little less, in their eyes, efficient, I guess. And as far as the union was concerned, it made it a lot safer. I don't know the exact particulars, but he said, a guy would come up to him and give him an envelope and say, "Here, this is for you." And he would just say, "Get lost, I don't want it." So they're trying to buy a guy like that off. And then, he went home once to his local neighborhood bar, and he said he was sitting there, and a gentleman walks in. An older guy dressed very nicely in a camel hair coat and comes walking towards him, calls his name. And as he turns around, the guy pulls out a gun and points it at him. And he pulls the trigger and like a red light comes out and he laughs and he turns around and he walks out of the bar. And this guy was maybe crazy enough or stubborn enough to still say, go screw yourself. But, I mean, so they can try to get to one person a level like that. Then it goes to a much higher level where, you've got bid rigging and, all sorts of stuff. The amazing thing is probably not how widespread this is, but that it's not universal. I mean, a lot of people are very brave and just tell these people to get lost, And I think they prey on the weak, and other times, they'll get a piece of a contractor, perhaps, or maybe they'll have influence in a union, and where they'll try and create some labor strife. But more often, the stuff comes through, a contractor will get a piece of a job, and then all of a sudden, he'll be going way over budget and everything else and milking it for everything he has. So, I mean, it's a variety of levels.
So what the mob is looking for when they infiltrate a construction company is money off the top.
Yeah, the thing is, you're dealing with these jobs that are really, they're hundreds of millions of dollars. They have construction loans that are probably a couple million dollars a month. And a lot of times it's easier just to pay someone off, than deal with the cost of any kind of delays, can far outweigh the cost of giving some guy, $10,000 a week in an envelope or whatever it might be.
So did you know people who actually worked for the mob?
Why are you asking so many questions, Derry?
You just tell me if you can't answer any of this. If you're better off not.
Yeah, I'm not bulletproof. No, I know people who worked with people, but I never really... it was something, there was always a guy on the job who was an ex-con who had been involved in something, but I never knew anyone who was actively doing anything in my experience.
I'm interested in hearing a little bit more about what it's like underground. What's the air like to breathe?
It varies. I mean, they're supposed to have these exhaust systems put in, and I recently went down to the second stage of the third water tunnel, and the air was better than I ever remembered it, and supposedly they have a new fan system that works really well. And it really sort of depended on what you were doing. I mean, when you were drilling and it was kicking up a lot of dust, or after you blasted, the air was very bad. Other nights, depending on the activity. I mean, like when you pour on concrete, you know, it's very hot and the air is very tight, but, you know, the air is not too cloudy. If you're doing stuff like before you concrete, you do something called blowing bottom, which essentially you get these big air cannons and you mix with water and you blow all the muck. And as you're blowing the muck, it kicks up in the air and you literally can't see 4 feet in front of you. And what that is, you have to ensure a proper bind with the concrete. So you have to get the rock so it's really glistening, so there's no dirt at all. So, I mean, if you're doing something like that, the air is just, you know, it's horrible. I mean, you can hardly breathe down there. And other nights, you know, if the excavation's been done and you're doing something like concreting, like I said, it's not as bad. So it really depended on the activity. And then sometimes, you know, the companies wouldn't, you know, if they were vigilant and were keeping the air, you know, the exhaust systems working, you know, that made a big difference too. Sometimes they didn't seem to care as much.
What would you wear to protect your eyes and your lungs?
Not much. The eyes, I mean, if you're doing something, you know, chipping or drilling, I mean, you really want to wear goggles because you get a lot of rock kickback in your face. But it's, you know, a lot of guys don't, which I think is kind of crazy. I always did. And the masks, you really, they give you like those cotton white masks, which I really don't think do much. They help a little bit, but in terms of silicosis, they don't filter out the microns, which really do the damage to your lungs. So,
is there a lot of illness from working underground?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know any retired sandhogs who aren't out on a silicosis or a caisson's disease disability. And besides, I mean, everyone's got rheumatism and arthritis and, you know, just from working in the damp for so long. But the silicosis is really the most virulent and debilitating of the diseases. And that's essentially, they also call it white lung disease, which you get from breathing silica. And essentially, it eats the elasticity out of your lungs, I guess is the best way to describe it. So, and it's something you can get. I mean, there were instances during the Depression when they were building some dams down south and drilling through high silica content to do tunnels where guys died from it in a matter of months. So, I mean, it can be extremely deadly. Usually it takes a matter of years, and you end up, like I said, very debilitated.
What's it like after a day's work when you're resurfacing back to the ground?
You know, it always felt good coming up, you know. I think, like I said, you never realize how sweet New York City air can taste, you know?
Yeah, well, not many people talk about how sweet New York City air is.
Yeah, so you would come up, and it depended. I mean, if you were working, I worked both swing shifts and graveyards, so a lot of times swing shift we would come up, and especially on payday, we'd head down to the local bar and cash our checks and have a few drinks and swap stories, and, you know, it was a lot of fun.
What was your favorite soap while you were working underground?
My favorite what?
Soap.
Soap?
Yeah.
You mean soap opera?
No, I mean to get clean after.
Yeah, well, they have what's called a hog house. So when you come out of the tunnel, there's a shower right there. So, you know, most other construction jobs, you leave and you go home. But Sandhogs, it's part of the contract. There's always a locker room on site. So you would come up, and they had this real, like, horrible industrial stuff that you could basically wash a battleship with, I guess.
I was lucky your skin can take it.
Yeah. I might end up, you know, the guys probably got sick from that in the long run.
Yeah. What's it like during blasting, and how much of the impact do you feel? Maybe you could describe that whole process when you're underground.
Sure. I mean, the blasting, what happens is you drill and you load a chute, and then you come back, and it depends on how much you're shooting, but usually you pull back, say, you know, 300 or 400 feet, maybe 500 feet, depending on how much you're shooting. Because the blast is designed in a way that first it blows the bottom out. It's all in time sequence. It's not just one big bang. I mean, it's hundreds of timed explosions going off. And so it's really like a ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-boom, and it builds to a crescendo. And so you don't have a lot of, it's designed in a way you don't have a lot of shrapnel, so you don't have to actually get out of the tunnel. I mean, it all kind of caves in on itself. But the noise, I mean, the first night I was down there when they blasted, it's almost indescribable. There's no way you'll ever hear anything as loud. I mean, first of all, you're using, you know, 100 pounds or more of explosives, and then you're in a very tight space. So yeah, the sound is incredible, and what happens is the air just gets sucked past you, and, you know, from the concussion. And it's, you know, the first time you think you're gonna die. I mean, the whole thing's gonna collapse. How could you have this powerful an explosion and the tunnel still be, you know, standing afterwards? So it's a pretty overwhelming experience.
Have you ever been working during a cave-in?
No, I was actually hit, though, in the head with a beam that fell and was hospitalized briefly with a slight concussion. And I was knocked out. I was walking down the tunnel one night, and nice as could be, next minute I know I'm on a stretcher. And what happened was they shore up the ceiling with sort of steel supports, and they put in, like, railroad ties. And one fell. Luckily, I was wearing a hard hat, you know, and I was only knocked out. I wasn't hurt too badly. If I didn't have a hard hat on, I probably would have been killed.
How long were you out of work?
Couldn't afford to stay out. I was back the next night with a stiff neck.
Now, did you think, maybe I won't go back?
You know, thank God I was young and dumb enough. I needed the money, and it was, you know, you think, okay, this happened, it means it's probably not going to happen tomorrow, you know. I mean, the scariest thing that I ever did down there was, and I described this, I used this scene in the book. We were working in a shaft, and they were cutting out the shaft steel, and we were on a platform that's suspended by cables, and a piece of the steel support that was being lifted out broke off and fell. And we were in the shaft, and we were on the bottom of this two-level platform, and you know something's coming down, and it's loud, and it's screaming, it's banging off the walls, and you just stand there in those few seconds and know there's absolutely nothing you can do. And I mean, that was a pretty terrifying moment. And one guy actually that was there that night, no one was hurt, luckily. I mean, people were banged up a little bit, but no one was hurt seriously. One guy never came back, and he had been working down there for 20 years, so.
During those few seconds when you saw what was happening, did you freeze? Did you try to duck?
Yeah, you know, an eerie calm came. I just sort of stood there and said, I guess there's realization that there's nothing you can do. The one guy who never came back, he sort of took it a little worse than others. He sort of had a reaction to it, you know, and then he left and he never came back. But for me, it was just, I kind of held my breath, you know.
And what happened afterwards? Was this... the sense of, ecstasy, we're still alive?
Yeah, we hit the bar and drank pretty heavily that night, you know. It was like, wow. It could have been a lot worse.
Well, Tom Kelly, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Tom Kelly's novel, Payback, has just been published in paperback. Our interview was recorded last year when the novel first came out. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we meet Dutch crime novelist Jan Willem van de Wettering. He's been a motorcycle gang member, lived in a Buddhist monastery in Japan, and worked as a cop in Amsterdam. Also, film critic John Powers reviews two new movies about infidelity, Afterglow and Live Flesh. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is a detective novelist who has not only worked as a cop, he spent 2 years studying in a Zen monastery in Japan. So it's no surprise that the bantering between the regular characters in his series, two cops and the chief of detectives, often has a philosophical edge. The author, Jan Willem van de Wettering, who now lives in Maine, grew up in Amsterdam and was a child during the German occupation of Holland. It was in Amsterdam that he worked as a cop. Most of his novels are set there. His latest novel is called The Perfidious Parrot. Last year, I asked van de Wettering to describe his position when he was a cop.
I was with the Reserve Constabulary of Amsterdam, but that's not really like an auxiliary force in the way you have it in other countries. We wore the same uniform as the Amsterdam Municipal Police, and we had the same training. The only thing was that we worked in our free time, our weekends and holidays, and we did the whole training also in our free time. So we had regular jobs at the same time. And the reason that I got into that was I left Holland when I was 19. I came back when I was 34, and I got arrested by the military police for not telling the Dutch consuls in foreign countries where I was in case Russia attacked and I have to help defend the country. So they wanted me to join the army at age 34 while I was already married and had a child and I had a good job in Holland at the time. So I'd rather not do that. But the choice was jail. So some lady at the office of the military police suggested that I'd quickly volunteer for the Amsterdam Voluntary Municipal Police because they definitely urgently needed extra people there. And once I was in the Queen's uniform as a policeman, I couldn't be in the army. So I did that, and it was funny to me because I'm really an anarchist, and here I was in this splendid uniform with a hat and serving the Queen by upholding the law.
You studied Zen Buddhism or practiced Zen Buddhism for a couple of years at a monastery in Kyoto. Do you think that your experiences in a Zen monastery influenced your behavior as a cop?
Yes, it was all part of my general upbringing.
Are there specific ways you think it affected you?
Yeah, dealing with human crises. As a cop, you always deal with... I remember coming home late at night and finding my wife embroidering something in front of the TV, and I'd think, where's the corpse? Where's the blood? Who is needing assistance here? And in Zen, you also in training, you also deal with a continuous crisis because your teacher, if you don't have the great doubt yourself, the great doubt about existence and about whether there is a meaning and a purpose and a pattern to life and whether you perform a useful part in there. If you have that doubt that maybe there's nothing at all, maybe it's just great chaos, a great void and emptiness. If you don't have that doubt, the teacher will actually put it in you and he will confront you with it every day. You have to see him early in the morning and he says, well, what of it? And what of it, he means, is you're on earth and have you figured out what you're doing here? And tell me. And he gives you these strange riddle-like koans to meditate on that don't seem to make any sense. Like the same thing with being a cop. When you look at the shadowy side of the suffering side of the humanity, you begin to doubt whether there's any sense to it.
But when you're a cop, you're kind of confronting that shadowy side day after day. When you're in a monastery, you're living in a secluded area, and you're through meditative practices confronting
this. Not in the Zen monastery.
No?
Yeah, you wake up at 3 because some idiot is banging on your door and yelling at you and clapping clappers, and then you have to report in the hall within 5 minutes, and there you get beaten if you fall asleep. And then an hour later, you have to see this fierce teacher who is like a dragon. You know, he just won't leave you alone. He'll drive you crazy. And then you have to do a lot of labor and hard work. And it's not your pleasant little hermit building where you sip tea and sit quietly.
What brought you to the Zen monastery in Kyoto? Why did you go?
Well, really, the war. I grew up in Rotterdam in Holland from a sort of comfortable family, and everybody knew exactly what they were doing, and we were living well. And then suddenly there was the war. All my schoolmates were Jewish and were killed. I'm not Jewish, so they left me alone, so I had survival guilt. I thought the whole thing was ridiculous. We did a lot of business with Germans, my father did, and they were bombing us and trying to kill us. Rotterdam was bombed in May 1940. It was the start of the war for the Dutch. And I was right in the middle of that. So I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't accept life. But then life was pretty exciting too, because wars are exciting. You know, there's all that war material, the uniforms later. The British planes came every day, and there were big fights above the lakeside where I lived. And it was a very colorful and very strange experience. So I thought maybe I'd just hold off on the suicide and see if I could make sense of it later. And eventually, after college, I went to England and studied philosophy in London. That was after a stint in South Africa, where I worked for one of my father's companies for 6 years and saw apartheid starting up, which was another horror. So I went to England, studied philosophy, and I really didn't get the answers or any answers except by reading Nietzsche, who also doubts the purpose of life.
Are you saying that you went to the Zen monastery because you were suicidal and nothing in your life, not philosophy classes, nothing else was helping?
No, because my suspicion was that there was no purpose and there was only chaos. And
no purpose to life.
Yeah, and that cheered me up. Because if it isn't there, then you don't have to worry about it.
Right, you don't have to have a purpose or a meaning if there isn't one to be had.
Yeah, and you could still, just to be perverse, do the very best you can.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what Nietzsche, I thought, was propagating. And I really got excited about that. And also about Heidegger and some of the existentialists who were coming from Sartre, for instance. And my teachers were just irritated by that and said, why don't you become a Buddhist instead of prattling about stuff like that? Enter the void, enter chaos, enter meaninglessness, as it is actually preached there or Taoism or Hinduism. So I thought, yeah, why not? And so I went to, I started reading Buddhism, and Japan seemed like a good place, because someone said if you get sick in Japan, you can go to a hospital, and you get bored, you can go to the cinema. You can't do that in Tibet or Calcutta so much. You know, Japan is an orderly country. And also, we had been at war with them, and a lot of my relatives were in Japanese camps in the Far East. So that would be another way to get to know a people who we had murderous relations with just shortly before. So I did go to Kyoto and stayed 2 years.
Now, did you have to explain all this to your Zen monk? I mean, to your Zen teacher?
No. He was a he was a great guy. That's why I stayed 2 years. Because when I came in, he said through an interpreter, "So what do you want?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to know if there is a purpose to life." And he said, "Well, do you think there is?" And I said, "Well, I'd rather think there isn't." He said, "Ah, that's great. Then, because at the end of your training, you will find that it was all a big joke anyway." And I said, "Well, concentration camps are a joke." And he said, "Yeah, maybe. You know, why don't you follow the method and come to some understanding?" And then I said, and also I'd been in money-making businesses, and I was bored with money. And he was a great actor. He got up and he said, "Don't tell me you don't have any money." And I said, no, it's okay. I brought some money." And he said, "What a relief." This monastery is a very expensive place to run. You know, things keep breaking down, they have to be fixed, and I smoke a lot of cigarettes. Cigarettes are getting very expensive. And if you have no money, I can't possibly have you here. I'll have to throw you out. So I said, no, don't worry, I have money. And then he charged me something like $6 a month.
It's so, nothing. I mean, right.
Yeah. And I realized that these guys were wise guys, you know. They were having fun with me, and I liked that. I thought that was very amusing.
So when you left the monastery after 2 years, did you feel any differently about the meaning of life?
No, I thought I had completely wasted my time. I was really depressed when I left. I never understood my koan and
the Zen koan, riddle that the teacher would give you. Mm-hmm.
And I was terrible at meditation, and my legs always hurt, and I couldn't stand the food. And the only guy I really liked was the teacher, and he was dying. He was suffering from Parkinson's disease, and he would have to retire pretty soon. And I thought I'd completely wasted my time. And I left and went to South America and got a job with a Dutch firm there. And for a while, I looked back thinking, what the hell was I trying to do there? But then it became clear that it had been a very meaningful exercise in meaninglessness. And I still think it's the greatest thing that ever happened to me now.
My guest is Jan Willem van de Wettering. He's the author of a series of detective novels set in Amsterdam, where he used to work as a cop. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dutch-born detective writer Jan Willem van de Wettering. Well, you in a book that you wrote about your experiences with Zen Buddhism, you said that your Zen master said to you when you were leaving, by leaving here, nothing is broken. Your training continues. The world is a school where the sleeping are woken up. You are now a little awake, so awake that you can never fall asleep again. Did those words have any meaning to you?
Yeah, I thought it was very nice of him to say that. And it would be nice if it was true. But I was more impressed by a character that he wrote for me, a Chinese character on a piece of paper, which the character for Mu, which means nothingness, the void, which was also the subject of my koan. And he put his own name on one side and my name on the other side. I thought that was a bit of a compliment that he would put me on the same. And he had done that before. I came at 3 o'clock in the morning. I came into his room and all miserable and itchy and bad tempered. And there he was climbing down from his cushions in his brocade robes and prostrating himself on the floor for me. And I said, "Hey, you know, are you okay?" And he said, no, I'm paying my respects to Jan Willem Buddha." And I said, "How do you mean?" He said, "Well, you know as much as I do, and you've always known it. And all this doubt and agony and pain that you present every day is really just a sham, you know." And that sort of thing always cheered me up. That's why I'm 65 now and I'm still around.
I'm wondering if you ever wondered whether the depressions you were experiencing were because of what you saw during the war, or whether it was just something more internal about your particular mood. You know how there's all these theories now about how depression is really linked to biochemical factors, and, you know, sometimes you really wonder whether your worldview is based on what you've experienced or just based on your internal chemistry.
Yeah, but it wasn't the sort of depression that you can cure with Prozac. It's
right, you saw it, I mean, right.
I think it'll happen to any thoughtful person. Mm-hmm. Carl Jung, mm-hmm. when he was a child, he had nice parents and he lived in the, you know, Carl Jung, the psychologist.
Yeah.
He was playing in the garden and he looked under some plants and he saw how ants are murdering a caterpillar. And then he went into that a little further and he saw how horrifying nature is. You know, everybody feeds on everybody else and all tearing each other up and cats playing with mice. And it will occur to anybody after a while. And I think any thoughtful person will then start pondering these matters. And they may be depressing, but they're also extremely interesting. You know, it's not the kind of depression where you think, well, I'll just shoot myself to have it over with. I was going to shoot myself to find God and beat him up. It was a fine thing to do. It was an adventure. You know, I wasn't going to just lie down and give up. Not that kind of depression at all.
What an interesting idea to kill yourself so you could find God and beat him up.
Yeah. My father was—he actually laughed at that, and he was a man weighed down by Christian grief and guilt. But when I told him that, he laughed. It was a good idea, he said. Try it.
What was the God you expected to find?
Well, what you were told in kindergarten, you know, an old guy with long hair and blue eyes and sort of beneficial. And I thought he was out of his mind if he was going to allow a whole class of little schoolboys, even if they were from expensive families and were taken to school in Mercedeses and Rolls Royces, to take them to Treblinka where they were just being killed within 6 hours. And he had thought of that as guidance, as a lesson, as training for our souls. He must be crazy. You know, somebody should go and tell him that things weren't working out. Later, I had more subtle thoughts about it.
Let me get back to what happened to you when you were young. How old were you when World War II started?
Nine.
And you were going to a very expensive private school because your father was a financier.
Yeah,
he had
everything
a lot of
was just dandy. You know? Mm-hmm, I walked through a park to school every day, but I did get mixed up in a hunger uproar one day. I strayed to the wrong side of town, and this was the 30s, so I was maybe 3-4 years old, and it was the Great Depression, and people were starving, and they were being subdued by Dutch military police with bearskins on horses and they rode their horses right into these poor people and then threatened them with sticks and sabers. So I knew something was amiss even before the war started.
Right. And during the war, during the German occupation of Holland, you said what, that all of the Jewish students in your class were taken to Treblinka, and you were the only student who wasn't Jewish.
Yeah, and two little boys who I always rather liked, they were Germans, but they happened to be in Holland, and they appeared at school in Hitlerjugend uniforms. And they were my schoolmates, you know. What did they know? They were 10, 11 years old at the time.
So all the Jewish students taken together at the same
no,
time?
No, it went by address, if you lived in a certain part of town. But most of them would have lived in the same area.
So every day there were fewer students?
There were fewer students, yeah. And they were wearing these yellow stars, and it was all ridiculous. But then later, we lived in a big house, a villa on the lakeside, and it was commandeered by the German army, but only half of it. So we had these, we were living in it, and German officers were living in it. And the officers all happened to come from Dresden in Germany, and that was one day completely destroyed, I think by the American Air Force or by the British.
The firebombing.
So I saw the distress of these kids, you know. They were young officers in their 20s. And the next thing, they were sent to Russia, and that was a one-way ticket too, because nobody came back from Russia in those days. So the suffering was universal. It wasn't just... you couldn't say, well, if the Germans are bad guys and we are good guys. It was a very mixed picture.
See, I'm interesting that as a child facing all this, what you found was meaninglessness as opposed to just a terrible fear of life and fear of...
No, I'm not into fear. I never had it very much. I'm more adventurous. I travel a lot, too. I lived in 10 different countries, and I've done all sorts of things.
Now, one of the characters in your mystery series is a jazz musician. He plays trumpet, and I understand that that's one of your ambitions, that one of your regrets, actually, that you don't play.
Yeah.
Why don't we end the interview with one of your favorite jazz trumpeters? Would you like to choose somebody?
Oh, Miles Davis.
Miles Davis? Okay. Is that how you would have liked to play if you could play?
Well, I don't want to imitate him, but I'm very pleased that at least somebody can play, because if I listen to him, all my questions really fall away. Music is such a direct way, and on his level, it's just beautiful.
Any particular Miles period you'd like to select?
Well, he had his own composition, So What?
Of course. The perfect choice for you. We'll play So What.
Yeah.
Jan Willem van de Wettering, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jan Willem van de Wettering's latest novel, The Perfidious Parrot, is published by Soho Press. Our interview was recorded last year. Coming up, reviews of two new movies about infidelity. This is Fresh Air. Our film critic John Powers has a review of two new movies about infidelity. Afterglow was directed by Alan Rudolph and stars Julie Christie and Nick Nolte. Live Flesh, which opened today in New York, is directed by Spanish filmmaker Pedro Almodovar.
Back in the 80s, Pedro Almodovar hit the international movie scene like a circus pulling into a dying village. Fast, reckless, and fun, he conjured up an imaginary Spain filled with psycho matadors, LSD-taking nuns, and big penis contests. But talents so incandescent have a tendency to fade quickly, and after his 1988 hit, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, he appeared to have lost inspiration. Movies like High Heels and Kika were slicker than his earlier work, but they lacked the old fire, the gleefully iconoclastic sense of danger. People began saying that Almodovar, still in his mid-40s, was finished. His new movie, Live Flesh, puts the lie to that thought. It's his best work in almost 10 years. Liberto Rabal plays Victor, an ardent young man who's harassing a woman, Elena, with whom he's fallen in love after one night stand, unaware that she thought he was lousy in bed. When two cops arrive, he accidentally shoots one, crippling him. 4 years later, Victor gets out of jail seeking something. Revenge, justice, love. Before you know it, he's sleeping with the wives of both the cops who sent him away, including his beloved Elena, who has become a social worker and married the wounded, wheelchair-bound cop. The film is based on a novel by British crime writer Ruth Rendell, but Almodovar transforms that book's staid sense of social realism into a piece of surrealism worthy of the great Luis Buñuel. Live Flesh brings together all of Almodovar's trademarks, good-looking men and passionate women, raunchy sex and casual violence, soap opera plotting and demonic laughter. And he gives them an unexpectedly resonant spin. Offering all the pleasures of a potboiler, it's actually a fable about guilt, coincidence, and the power of destiny. You could say the same of the latest film by Alan Rudolph, another daring director who's fallen from favor in the 90s. It's called Afterglow, and it too turns on adultery. Laura Flynn Boyle is Marianne, a sexually frustrated wife who yearns to become a mother, but is rebuffed by her husband Jeffrey, a corporate shark played by Johnny Lee Miller. Needing some work on their posh apartment, Marianne hires a handyman named Lucky, played by Nick Nolte. Lucky's the philandering husband of Julie Christie's character, a retired B-movie actress named Phyllis, who turned off to her husband after their teenage daughter Cassie ran away from home. A perfect match, the yearning housewife and the womanizing husband are soon in each other's arms, a liaison which prompts Jeffrey and Phyllis to attempt the same thing. But the bonds of marriage run deep, as is clear when Lucky and Phyllis have dinner together at an Italian restaurant.
You know, the hardest part of all, Lucky, is finding out too late that none of it lasts.
Bulb's got to blow out sooner or later, babe.
Yes, lights out sooner or later.
Yeah. But you know, the good stuff's still hiding in the dark.
In the afterglow, I saw Cassie today.
As a director, Rudolph has one of the world's most beautiful styles. His sense of color, composition, and camera movement is nothing short of exquisite. But for the first 30 minutes, Afterglow is so painfully clunky that it's tempting to walk out. Don't. For eventually Rudolph pulls things together, and the movie becomes unexpectedly poignant, evoking the melancholy radiance of love after the initial passion has flamed out. Although Laura Flynn Boyle and Johnny Lee Miller are frankly pretty bad, they're probably in the film to attract younger viewers, the movie's saved by their older co-stars. After his goofy start, Nolte settles into one of those wounded bear roles that nobody does better. He seems to carry pain in his very flesh. And starring as a guarded, world-weary woman, Christie looks more ravishing than ever, precisely because her youthful beauty now wears the eloquent etching of time. By turns heartbreaking and corrosively funny, her performance is a triumph of economy. Without ever seeming to do anything, she manages to suggest everything. Christie's star may not burn as bright as it did in the days of Darling and Shampoo, but she's proof that there is something wonderful about an afterglow.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Bob Purdick, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tude directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.